Okay, thank you. We have previously been called to order. So the next argument is the third argument on the oral argument calendar for this panel today. There are two consolidated cases. The first is A21-330, Minnesota Democratic Farmer Labor Party, by Ken Martin versus Steve Simon. The second case is number A21-403, Noah McCourt versus Secretary of State Steve Simon. As everyone involved in the case is aware, the court previously issued an order granting appellant DFL party's motion for additional argument time. The relators collectively will be allowed 25 minutes for their principal argument and 8 minutes for their rebuttals. The respondent will be allowed 25 minutes of oral argument in response. Now, I think when I return to the Zoom connection, I was just hearing some conversation about the division of time. So I should ask relators counsel that the 25 minutes of initial oral argument time, is that being divided evenly or otherwise?
It's being divided 13-12, Your Honor.
And which relator has 13 minutes?
The DFL party.
Okay. Is there also an agreement about which relator goes first?
Yes. I will be going first on behalf of the DFL party.
Okay. And then with respect to the 8 minutes of rebuttal?
Yes, we're splitting that 3 minutes for Mr. McCourt, who will be going first, and 5 minutes for the DFL, and I'll be going last.
Thank you. Counsel for Mr. McCourt, I see that two of you are seated at a table. Am I correct in assuming that just one of you will be presenting oral argument?
Sort of, Your Honor. I will be presenting our principal argument for the most part, and depending on how it goes, it'll be either me or Mr. Troutman for rebuttal.
Okay. That's a little bit unconventional, but I won't disallow it. What appellate courts generally don't like is not knowing who's going to answer the question and have a lot of back and forth. So I think it would be important for you to designate the lawyer at the beginning of that part of your argument, and that lawyer then can speak on behalf of your client with respect to all issues and all questions that may be asked. Acceptable?
That's acceptable. So if it is uneasy for the court to have me do the rebuttal, we'll just have counsel saying do both the argument and the rebuttal.
I'll let you decide when it's time for your rebuttal argument. I'll just refer to counsel for relator McCourt, and you may choose at that time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Very good. So we're ready to begin. Ms. Kitsy Collins, on behalf of Relator DFL Party, you may introduce yourself and your client and begin.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Rachel Kitsy Collins. I'm an attorney at Lockridge Grindle Nowen, appearing today on behalf of the appellant Ken Martin in his capacity as chair of the Democratic Farmer Labor, or DFL Party, of Minnesota. Your Honors, the district court's decision dismissing the DFL's complaint should be reversed and remanded for consideration on the merits for three reasons. First, the DFL's claim is ripe because it faces a credible threat of enforcement. Second, the claim is justiciable because the Secretary of State is adverse to the party. And third, the historic lack of enforcement does not bar the party's claim. Now, Your Honors, all of these issues on appeal really boil down to this question of enforcement. So let me begin by putting this case in its proper context. This is a challenge under the First Amendment to a state statute that unconstitutionally interferes with the DFL party's right to political association. And in cases such as this, pre-enforcement challenges are not only allowed, but encouraged as a mechanism for a party to clarify its rights under the statute while complying with the law rather than simply violate the law and risk the consequences. There's no dispute here that the DFL has alleged that it would like to engage in conduct prohibited by the statute, but it has chilled its speech and reliance on the statute by limiting participation in the caucuses to eligible voters. The only dispute is whether the DFL's decision to chill its speech is objectively reasonable, which requires the court to find it faces a credible threat of prosecution. Now, this
can
is-
could I stop you there, Ms. Kitsey-Collins? Yes. I'm looking at your brief where you have essentially two brief points. And the first one, the second one, your brief point is that the Secretary of State is a proper defendant and has authority to enforce the law. It was my impression when reading your brief that perhaps that issue should be first, or that it's a threshold issue, or that it comes before the other issue. If you cannot establish on appeal that the Secretary of State is a proper defendant, then do your other arguments really matter?
Well, Your Honor, all of these issues are interrelated. So let me start with the standard for what makes a defendant proper. Under the First Amendment case law, the defendant does not need to be the sole authority or even the primary authority to administer or enforce the statute. He only needs to have some connection to the challenged statute. Now, we've outlined three different enforcement mechanisms that could be used here to enforce the statute, and all of these are connected to the Secretary of State. So if I may, I'm going to walk through these three mechanisms. So first is felony prosecution. The statute directly incorporates the voter eligibility requirements and penalties of Minnesota Statute Section 201.014, which provides that a person who votes who knowingly is not eligible to vote is guilty of a felony.
So, Ms. Kitsey-Collins, if I may stop you there, and I'm glad you raised this, because I was going to ask about this. So this would be a matter of statutory interpretation, and the first time, at least in my, that appellate court has addressed this specific issue. Is that fair to say?
Yes, Your Honor. Yeah.
And, you know, I noticed you raised this in your reply brief. I don't recall, but you know your briefing better than I do, that this was raised in the in your principal brief. Is that properly before us?
Your Honor, it was raised in our principal brief. We discussed the statutory interpretation that the voter eligibility statute is incorporated into the caucus eligibility statute right at the beginning of our principal brief. We walked through the statutory interpretation there. So, and we also raised it at the district court, Your Honor, both in our briefing and in our argument.
Well, if I may then, I mean, I see that as an issue that at least raises the possibility, depending upon our interpretation of those provisions, of criminal prosecution, which gets to my bigger issue, which I assume is going to come up in your second issues of what counts as enforcement. You know, when I read the cases that, you know, you all are relying on, you know, First Amendment challenges, and the enforcement types, all of those enforcement types, but I may have missed some, were criminal prosecution, you know, misdemeanors, gross misdemeanors, felonies. So is it fair to say, I mean, and where the other types of, you know, enforcement that you primarily were talking about here, you know, is the secretary's, you know, website instructions, the possibility of a, you know, civil, assume injunctive relief, you know, do those really even count about whether those are credible threats of criminal prosecution?
Well, two responses to that, Your Honor. First, the Eighth Circuit and 281 Care Committee did recognize that non-criminal consequences are sufficient to demonstrate a credible threat of enforcement to sustain a First Amendment claim. And that's at page 630 of that opinion. And second, the voter eligibility requirements provide that if a person who votes who knowingly is not eligible to vote, they're guilty of a felony. So that's a felony prosecution. And nothing in the voter eligibility statute limits it to elections. It just says a person who votes illegally is guilty of a felony. It doesn't say that a person who votes in an election is guilty of a felony. So the only—
Yes, but if I may, Ms. Kitsey-Collins, I'm looking at under the eligibility to vote statute. And, you know, subdivision one talks about the following requirements at the time of an election is eligible to vote. That would seem, just under the plain meaning reading of the statute, to refer that these votes, you know, and what counts as kind of that knowingly voting when you're not eligible to be voting in an election, wouldn't you say?
No, Your Honor, because the election is merely the point in time at which we determine eligibility. So the caucus eligibility statute states in subdivision one that only those individuals who are or will be eligible to vote at the time of the next election can participate in the caucuses. And similarly, the eligibility to vote statute states that these are the requirements that must be met at the time of the election. But subdivision three of 201.014, outlining the penalty, just says any individual who votes, who knowingly is not eligible, is guilty of a felony. It doesn't limit it to elections, Your Honor. And go ahead.
If I may, I didn't see any reference to legislative history. Did you look to see if there is any legislative history that would address whether or not we're talking about just voting in an election or voting at a precinct caucus or elsewhere?
No, Your Honor, we did not locate legislative history on this. No. So let me just quickly walk through the other two enforcement mechanisms that we've raised. And the first is a voter challenge. Minnesota Statute 201.195 allows any individual to challenge the eligibility of another voter in their county. These challenges go first before the county auditor, but then can be appealed to the Secretary of State, who has to rule on the eligibility of the voter. So that's another way in which the secretary is directly responsible for enforcement of the statute. And the third is a civil action. If the DFL chose to simply amend its constitution to allow non-eligible voters to vote in violation of the statute, the secretary has the authority to bring a civil declaratory judgment action to compel compliance with the statute. And as I mentioned, the Eighth Circuit has held that these sorts of non-criminal consequences are sufficient to demonstrate a credible threat. So we have three enforcement mechanisms: felony prosecution, voter challenges, and a civil action. And therefore, there is a credible threat of prosecution under the statute.
If I may ask about your Eighth Circuit authority, make sure I understand. I thought in 281 Care Committee that the enforcement mechanism there was a gross misdemeanor, kind of enforced by a county attorney. Was I wrong about that? Or maybe you're referring to another case?
Your Honor, I believe the statute provided that criminal penalties were possible for violations, but the only enforcement that had occurred was an administrative hearing. And the court noted that these types of civil enforcement actions are sufficient to sustain a claim as well. Now, I want to move on to subdivision three of the caucus eligibility statute, because I believe this is where the district court its fundamental error, because it found that subdivision three vests enforcement with the party. But this is simply an incorrect reading of the statute. Subdivision three refers to determining the right of an individual to participate at the caucus, not the right of an individual to vote at the caucuses. And this is an important distinction because, for example, the DFL allows 16-year-olds to participate at the caucus. They can come and do things such as introduce resolutions, but they still can't vote or be elected delegates. So it makes sense that Subdivision 3 vests with the party the right to determine who participates, that broader scope of who participates. But the right to vote is still limited by the objective criteria in Subdivision 1. So the district court was simply incorrect in finding that Subdivision 3 vests enforcement over voting with the party. And also, it doesn't preclude any of the other enforcement mechanisms that we've discussed. Now, we've touched on why the Secretary of State is the proper defendant here, that he does not need to be the sole or even the primary authority to enforce the law. And I want to draw this court's attention to a ruling in May, Schroeder v. Simon, where a plaintiff challenged the constitutionality of the criminal statute, which identifies the circumstances under which the voting rights of felons may be restored. The secretary was the only named defendant in that case, even though his only real connection was in maintaining the voter rolls. The secretary doesn't get to decide when a felon is restored to his civil rights. He's basically a record keeper. But neither the secretary nor the district court nor this court raised any question as to whether he was a proper defendant. And so I think that case is instructive here, where we're also dealing with issues of voter eligibility. And the secretary is also involved directly in the caucus process. He administers and reports the results of the gubernatorial preference ballot. He issues guidance to local officials regarding the caucuses, and prepares and publicizes information to the public regarding the caucuses. And none of these guides or informational documents state that only the party enforces the right to vote. They all contain the restriction on the right to vote. Now, the final issue is whether the lack of enforcement bars the party's claim. And the answer to this is just unequivocally no. In First Amendment cases, even the total lack of enforcement does not bar a claim. And the district court and the secretary erroneously rely on Poe v. Ullman, but that is simply not a useful or controlling precedent here. Poe involved a challenge to a Connecticut statute that prohibited the use of contraceptives. The court found the case was not justiciable because there was no record of the statute being enforced in its 80-year history, despite the fact that it was openly and notoriously violated. Contraceptives were openly sold in drugstores, yet there was no record of enforcement. By contrast, here, the two major political parties have conformed their behavior to the law. They've written into their constitutions the requirement that only eligible voters can vote at the caucuses. And so I will point this court to San Francisco Central Committee v. U, the Ninth Circuit decision, which recognized that despite lack of enforcement of a statute for over 20 years, this was not a relevant factor when the parties had conformed to the statute. Lack of enforcement only proves that a statute has been rejected if there have been violations to remedy.
If I may, counsel, I had a question for you about that case, which I know you relied upon, and so I, you know, looked at it. It was unclear to me, you know, going back to my concern about what are credible threats of criminal prosecution, whether or not the criminal laws were involved or not. I think there was a footnote that was hard for me to decipher. Do you have any light you could shed on that?
Your Honor, I don't have much more to say about that. The state did argue in that case that there were not criminal consequences. And Your Honor notes the vague footnote in the Ninth Circuit decision. The Supreme Court did say there were criminal and civil penalties. Unfortunately, the statute has been repealed. I was unable to to actually find the plain language of the statute. But I think that case shows that even when it's somewhat unclear as to whether there are criminal penalties, the point is that in a First Amendment case, the injury is the chilling of the speech, and the lack of enforcement does not bar a claim, particularly when the statute has been followed. I see that I'm out of time, so I respectfully request this court reverse and remand for consideration on the merits. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kitsy Collins. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Before the next argument, I should say I may have misspoken when referring to the parties as relators. The order that I signed last week referred to them as relators. That may be a mistake. I assume that the case comes to us on notices of appeal, in which case the parties are should be referred to as appellants, and so I apologize for that. So, counsel for appellant McCourt, you may begin your argument.
Good morning, Your Honors. Ms. Kitsy Collins has...
Could I ask you at the beginning of your argument just to identify yourself and your client, please? Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Amrita Singh. I'm here on behalf of Mr. Noel McCourt, who is appealing the matter against the Secretary of State. Ms. Kitsy Collins has, for the most part, very articulately made most of our arguments. The distinguishing element between the DFL's case and Mr. McCourt's case is that Mr. McCourt is an individual who has specific experience of how, he is a specific example of how speech has been chilled by this statute. Specifically, the matter is ripe because he also not only has the DFL adopted the statute's language into its constitution, as Ms. Kitsy Collins stated earlier, but Mr. McCourt has also decided that he cannot participate in the DFL caucus because of the statute. He is actively completing the terms of his probation as a person who has a felony conviction, and his probation requires that he may remain law-abiding. And based on the language of the statute and the DFL's constitution, it is not in his interest to violate the statute by exercising his First Amendment rights, because it would also be a violation of his probation.
So, Ms. Singh, if I may, so from your client's perspective, what besides the language of the statute itself, maybe that's all that there is, convinces him that there is a credible threat of prosecution? Because I think that's what a lot of this boils down to. And tell me, and you can feel free to disagree with me about that too.
Very honestly, I'm going to sort of make a hypothesis on my client's behalf, because he's obviously not here to speak for himself. But I think as a member of our society and considering the punitive nature of our justice system, I think for someone who has a felony conviction, the idea that he would be violating a law by participating in something that he can be seen in and would be bringing attention to himself potentially by participating in the caucus, I think just the context of existing with those circumstances is enough to be a legitimate concern that there would be consequences for participating and in turn violating the statute.
If I may ask a follow-up, because this was not clear to me in your briefs, is it your client's position, as I understand it, is the DFL's, that the felony provisions or consequences from Minnesota Statute 202A.16, the eligibility to vote 201.014, anyone who knowingly is not eligible to vote and does it is guilty of a felony. And let's see, 204C.14, which also has kind of a violation of this chapter's a felony, that those apply to voting in caucuses, not just in general election or in elections.
I would agree with Ms. Kitsy Collins' analysis in that the statute refers to, the statute doesn't it indicates the timing based on election, and also, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Your Honor. Can you please repeat the question?
It was breaking up just a little bit. I think we caught about 80%.
I apologize. So, does your client take a position on whether the unlawful voting provisions of Minnesota Statute 201.014 and 204C.14 apply to voting in a caucus?
Yes, because the way the statute is written, it is specific to, he reads it as, it applies to him based on whether or not he's able to vote in general elections. And the fact that he is not able to do so is how it applies to him in the caucus, because that's what the statute is referring to.
Counsel, is there any reason he didn't ask his probation officer whether he'd get in trouble if he did that? Be nice to hear what that.
I do not know the answer to that, Your Honor. I don't know that he didn't. it's not something that we discussed, I guess. I don't know. I don't have the information on that. I'm sorry. So in addition to the matter is ripe because his speech has been chilled, Ms. Kitsy Collins also referred to this, but in a case that we cited in our brief, Kruger versus Zeman Construction Company, to suffer an injury in fact, a party must allege a concrete and particularized invasion of a legally protected interest, which obviously here is his First Amendment right to free speech that he is unable to exercise by participating in the caucuses. One of the points in the order for dismissing our claim in district court was that there's no justiciable controversy. The court has the ability to redress Mr. McCourt's injury by ordering a declaratory judgment that either the statute is unenforceable the way that it's written, or it's unenforceable because it's unconstitutional. And so that is the relief we are seeking, which obviously indicates that there is a justiciable controversy, because that is something that would provide him the relief that he is seeking. By deeming it unenforceable, it is not to say that the Secretary of State is not the correct defendant. It is simply saying that the way that it's written, the consequences of violating that statute and the language of the statute on the whole is so vague that it is unenforceable. So I just want to make that distinction, that that does not speak to whether or not the secretary is the correct defendant. And then, and also finding that it's unconstitutional, obviously, because we feel that it is restricting his right to free speech. So respectfully, Your Honors, we request that one of those be the outcome in a declaratory judgment in our client's favor. So thank you.
It appears there are no further questions for you. Thank you for your argument. Counsel for respondent, you may identify yourself and your client and begin your argument, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Stephen Melchioni, Assistant Attorney General for the State of Minnesota. I am here today representing Secretary of State Steve Simon, who was named as defendant in both of the actions before this court that were consolidated by this court. Initially, it is worth noting some of the procedural posture issues that we are dealing with. Both of the district court orders in this case are fairly similar in that they took the ripeness issue first and then addressed the propriety of the Secretary of State as defendant second. Judge Johnson's question was apposite in that whether or not the Secretary of State is the appropriate defendant is a threshold issue. The reason the district court addressed it in this manner is because both arguments were made in the alternative and both provide completely independent bases to affirm the dismissal of the complaints in both of these matters. The reason to address ripeness first is because the question of whether or not the case is ripe also implicates some of the propriety of the defendant, of the Secretary of State as defendant issues. But even if the claim is ripe, even if they can overcome the standard in 281 CARES, either plaintiff, the question still remains whether the Secretary of State is the person they should be suing in that respect. What I would note is that both courts addressed that in a similar manner. Both relied on 281 CARES, both relied on Poe v. Ullman. The McCourt court also addressed the Secretary of State's argument for failure to state a claim. That is because the one way in which the McCourt complaint differed is that it also alleged a violation of the statute itself. That was not addressed by the district court, so those merits should not be addressed here. It was simply found that there was no claim stated against the Secretary of State because the Secretary of State did nothing to prevent Mr. McCourt from actually attending the caucus.
So, Mr. Melchioni, so after hearing Ms. Kitsikallins' answer to my question, I mean, is it not true that we must consider perhaps four different avenues or mechanisms by which the Secretary of State might conceivably, possibly, enforce the statute? One of them being subdivision 3 of 202A16, and then the second, third, and fourth being the three identified by her in her question. In other words, can we foreclose the possibility of enforcement by the Secretary without eliminating all four of those possibilities?
I think it is worth considering all of those, but when we look at each of those independently as addressed in our, as addressed in the respondent's principal brief and addressed by the court below, not all of them actually apply to this case. I'm going to apologize. My screen has frozen, so I'm wondering if everyone can still hear and see me.
Your audio has been continuous. We heard your complete answer, so the frozen video is not an issue. Please proceed.
I would like to address each of those independently.
Just to be clear, since you've paused, I mean, it seems to me that your, for you to prevail, you would need to show us that either for each of those four, either there's no authority or the prospects of enforcement are so remote as to be to not meet the ripeness standard. Am I understanding the analysis correctly?
I think that would be the appropriate analysis, although for some of these, it is facially patent that the Secretary of State is not the appropriate defendant, so they don't necessarily need that level of analysis. For example, the enforcement mechanisms in 202A.16 subdivision 3 only deals with the caucus adjudication of whether someone can participate. It does not mention the Secretary of State. The Secretary of State has no role in 202A.16 subdivision 4. So let me address each of the three enforcement mechanisms that counsel mentioned. First and foremost, 201.014, the fact that that voting in a general election is a felony, I think that is the appropriate analysis of the statute based upon the plain language of the statute, which starts by saying that except as provided in subdivision 2, an individual who meets the following requirements at the time of an election. They're discussing specifically at the time of an election whether someone is eligible to vote. The reference, therefore, in subdivision 3 for the penalties is limited by subdivision 1, talking about voting at the time of an election. This is typically a general election. On year, off year doesn't really matter, but what we are talking about are elections. While it is true that the voter eligibility is determined at the time of election, and that voter roll is used for the caucus process, it is not the same process, and therefore it is not the similar penalty. So it is the Secretary of State's position that 201.014 provides no criminal penalty for someone who would vote in the caucus, regardless of whether they were eligible or not. Additionally, the Secretary of State doesn't enforce this statute. This is the fact that there could be a felony penalty, the Secretary of State is not a prosecutor, doesn't bring charges. This would be something for a local enforcement authority. And 281 cares.
Isn't that a little disingenuous? I mean, the Secretary of State's not the enforcement, it's not the, you know, the county attorney or something, but the Secretary of State's the one that, you know, makes that initial eligibility decision. Or at least refers issues to what, the county auditor? There's a whole process behind this that the Secretary is involved in, correct?
Yes, the Secretary of State does provide the actual voter roll itself, but the inclusion of any individual on that voter roll is not before this court. That is Schroeder v. State. That's the case that's been accepted by the Supreme Court earlier this year. Whether or not a felon being included or excluded from the voter roll is constitutional is not the question before this court. The question here is, knowing that someone is properly not included on that voter roll, is also excluding them from the caucus constitutional? And what I would posit is that even that question is not before this court. This court is only addressing the procedural questions that were raised and decided below, the actual merits of the arguments as raised in McCourt's appellate brief are not before this court. We are not addressing the actual constitutionality here. What we are addressing is whether this case is procedurally brought properly. And if you look at 281 CARES, the case everyone is relying on, the defendants in that case consisted of four county attorneys who had the obligation to enforce felony penalties or misdemeanor penalties for violation of those statutes. In this case, there is no county attorney associated here. The Secretary of State is not that enforcement authority.
If I may, is it your client's position then that when we're analyzing whether there's a credible threat of prosecution that or enforcement, that means a credible threat of criminal prosecution? Is that your client's position?
In this instance, yes, because that is the identified mechanism. And the cases, all of the cases that we have cited here, to the best of my knowledge, and I've reread them all very recently, involve some type of criminal penalty associated with the exercise of that right.
What about the Ninth Circuit case that Ms. Kitsy Collins and I were talking about? That was where kind of there was a question about, was the legislature really going too far and delving into the party, governance?
That audio was breaking up just a little bit. Could you repeat that question?
Could you address the Ninth Circuit decision I think it was the U case where it was at least questionable whether we had the specter of criminal prosecution in that case?
Yes, Your Honor. So there are two different reasons that U is distinguishable. First and foremost, U was a case in which parties were prohibited from making endorsements during their own primary processes. It's really an entirely different question because the prohibition was on the party itself. Additionally, Hughes' holding was really an apposite because the instances there, the prohibition was applied to party leadership who couldn't speak their mind about who they were endorsing. Additionally, that case relies on Babbitt, and Babbitt is a criminal prosecution case. So the ins and outs of that Ninth Circuit case are kind of hard to determine because, as Ms. Kitsy Collins, just like her, I was unable to actually ascertain exactly what that statute said at the time it was decided. But because of the heavy reliance on Babbitt, that case is fundamentally founded in a credible threat of criminal prosecution because that's what was at issue in Babbitt. So as far as we know, that's the world they were living in, was credible threat of criminal prosecution. So, and again, that does involve both questions. Whether there is a credible threat of criminal prosecution, the ripeness question, and whether the Secretary of State is the proper defendant to adjudicate that issue. These two questions are very interrelated, but I don't want to lose sight of the fact that they are both independent bases for this court to affirm the district court. The district court could be entirely wrong on the ripeness question, and the Secretary of State should still prevail on the other justiciability issue because the Secretary of State is not the appropriate defendant. But dealing with the other two items identified as possible enforcement mechanisms, the voter challenge statute of 201.095, similar to the criminal enforcement, that is only dealing with whether someone is on the voter roll. That is the challenge identified in 201.095, whether someone is on that list. Again, that's a Schroeder v. Secretary case. That's the question of whether someone is properly on the voter roll at all, which isn't before this court. The question here is only assuming someone is properly excluded from those voter rolls, is it a violation of their First Amendment right to participate in the caucus, and is the secretary the appropriate defendant? Because the secretary's only role is establishing those voter rolls, and they are not at issue in this case, the secretary is not the appropriate defendant, which, when Ms. Kitsy Collins addressed Schroeder, that is the distinction. In that case, justiciability was not raised. And I'm not gonna speak to why it was or why it wasn't. That is a strategic choice for a different attorney in a different case, but it is substantially different on the merits. Lastly, the idea that the secretary could bring a civil action. There is no case that I am aware of where that has ever happened in relation to caucus participation. In almost 50 years of the statute's existence, that would be a true ripeness challenge. And again, that is not a criminal prosecution. There are multiple enforcement mechanisms within the statute itself, the caucus voting on whether someone can or cannot participate, and additionally, the criminal prosecution statute, if that applied to the caucus, which we don't believe it does. But again, the secretary's belief as to whether or not it applies doesn't really matter, because the secretary is not the criminal enforcement authority, which brings us to the
So if we look at enforcement more broadly than just criminal prosecution, at least there's, you know, some language that might enable us to do that. Why wouldn't the guidelines that the secretary has put on their website about precinct voting, why isn't that effectively enforcement?
Because the Secretary of State on the website has published what the statutes are without comment as to whether or not they are good or enforceable. These are the statutes. It's essentially a reference system. We wouldn't be suing the state law library for publishing the statute books. That's essentially what you're dealing with here. The Secretary of State has an obligation to identify the statutes and what they are and how the system works. That doesn't mean the Secretary is going to take civil action to enforce those statutes in a case where the Secretary does not believe the Secretary has the authority to do so. And this is not simply a case of destitute or of disavowance. One of the things that comes up in the briefing a lot is that the Secretary has not affirmatively disavowed this statute, i.e. it is still published on the website. But affirmative disavowal is not the touchstone under 281 CARES. And the Secretary has no obligation to affirmatively disavow a statute where the Secretary is not the enforcing authority. So just because the Secretary hasn't made a statement to disavow the statute hasn't been enforced in 50 years. And the appropriate enforcement authority is either the DFL's caucus itself or the criminal prosecuting authority. So for those reasons, those differently identified enforcement mechanisms aren't actually effective. But again, I would note for the court, it's important to pull those apart and identify whether we're talking about ripeness in toto, whether these claims are ripe in general, and whether the secretary is the appropriate defendant. Either one is an independent basis for affirming the dismissals of the district court below. And I agree with Judge Johnson. It is appropriate to address the secretary's fitness first, because that would obviate the need for any question as to ripeness. But when getting to ripeness, every party here agrees that 281 CARES is the touchstone, but interpret that case differently. And as Ms. Kitsy Collins stated in her opening argument, the question here isn't really whether the DFL and Mr. McCourt want to engage in this conduct. There's no evidence that they don't. They've both submitted affidavits that they want to engage in this conduct. The DFL has submitted affidavits saying that they have affirmatively chilled their participation based on this statute. So then the question, again, only dealing with ripeness, not whether the secretary is the appropriate defendant, the question becomes whether you have an objectively reasonable basis upon which to chill your speech. And that's where the rubber meets the road for that argument. And both district courts address that in the same manner, deciding that based upon all of the history and the statutes, chilling your speech based upon this statute is not objectively reasonable. So
I have a question I don't want to interrupt any other judges' line of questioning, but I have a question about 202A 16 and subdivision 3, the phrase right to participate is used. What does that mean exactly? What is encompassed within the word participate?
It is the secretary's position that the participation includes every part of the caucus. So whether that is voting or speaking or proposing amendments, it wouldn't make much sense if subdivision 3 only applied as a statutory interpretation matter. If subdivision 3 only applied to showing up and speaking, that wouldn't make much sense because subdivisions 1 and 2 both address different requirements and different ways in which someone participates at the caucus. As is evident by Chairman Martin's affidavit, the caucus has many different facets to it and many different ways in which someone can participate. And that is all encompassed in subdivision 3. Because then in subdivision 4 immediately following, no person may vote or participate at more than one party's caucus. So you can't vote or participate in any fashion in two different caucuses. So whichever caucus you're participating in, that's where you're doing everything. I can't participate in the DFL caucus and then go vote in the Republican caucus.
Next question about this statute is, if an individual, perhaps Mr. McCourt, perhaps any other individual, is not eligible to vote and therefore not eligible to vote in the precinct caucus under the statute, but wishes to challenge the constitutionality of that statute, and if there's a vote of the whole caucus which rejects or affirms, which results in the decision that the individual cannot vote at the caucus, then what is the proper, first of all, is that decision of the whole caucus subject to review in a judicial action? And if so, what is the appropriate mechanism for a person such as Mr. McCourt to pursue in order to get the constitutionality of the statute reviewed?
Well, I would, first and foremost, it's not really the secretary's place to give litigation strategy to other attorneys, but that's essentially what this statute does, is it provides for the vote of the caucus and then no more. It doesn't provide a right to appeal. If someone were to avail themselves of any other mechanism by which they could have that reviewed judicially, that may be a ripe case in controversy. It would depend on the facts and circumstances of that case, but it would not involve the Secretary of State, because the Secretary of State makes no decision and has no part of that. Because again, the voter rolls that the Secretary of State maintains are not in question here. We all agree that the people we're talking about are not on those voter rolls. They are not eligible voters, and their eligibility to vote is not part of the 202A.16 challenge. That would be part of a 201.091 challenge, which would be an entirely different process.
I'd like to clarify, and perhaps by sharpening my question. So if an individual wishes to challenge his ineligibility to vote at the caucus for a constitutional reason, and if the whole caucus says that based on the statute he's ineligible to vote, are you saying that there is no opportunity for the person to obtain judicial review of the constitutionality of the statute?
Not precisely. What I'm saying is the statute does not identify the form or function or manner in which that review is obtained. Whether or not judicial review is appropriate would be a justiciability question for a different lawsuit. If that person, say, were to sue the caucus or the party, that court would have to make some of these same justiciability questions if it were raised as a defense, but that would be a completely different case.
I mean, we're, you know, in arguing that the actions of these two appellants is not justiciable, I guess it might give us more comfort if we knew that there were some other avenue available to interested persons in order to ensure that their constitutional rights were vindicated if in fact they have a meritorious constitutional right. I mean that's the basis of my question. I understand that it's I'm asking for about a question about facts that are not before us, but I'm just wondering if the alternative is that there's never any review, or I don't think you've said that. I think you've said it's something else, but you haven't described it with specificity. Is that fair?
Because I don't know exactly what that would look like. But
neither do I. That's why I'm asking.
One of the analogies I draw is when there's a dispute between two private parties, they can obtain judicial review of that, whether through declaratory judgment or some other action. It doesn't necessarily involve the state. But one of the instances here, if you look to the arguments made below in the McCourt matter, part of his claim was the actions of the DFL in excluding him from the caucus. The court didn't reach that because there was ultimately no actual allegations of who, what, or when he was excluded from the caucus. But that would create an entirely different controversy, not between the secretary and Mr. McCourt or the secretary and the DFL, but between Mr. McCourt and the DFL. That would be an entirely different case. That is not necessarily the case here because the allegations were not made in the complaint or proffered on a motion for summary judgment.
If I may jump in here with a slightly different question. My concern, speaking just for myself and not for the panel, when looking at whether the issue of whether the Secretary of State has authority to enforce the statute 202A.16, is that if we say, no, it doesn't, then that would mean that not just your client, but future secretaries of state couldn't, upon learning that someone who was not eligible to vote actually did vote in a caucus, couldn't do an investigation and perhaps bring a injunctive, you know, depending on the results of that investigation, I'll hold a press conference, bring a request for injunctive relief against a party who violated the statute. And I'm not saying I'm not saying you could or couldn't do that, but we would be eliminating that possibility. I mean, doesn't that cause some concern for, I mean, thinking of the office itself, not just the person who's holding it right now?
No, that is precisely the argument the Secretary of State is making, is that this is not just a case of lack of enforcement. It is a case where the legislature has not provided the Secretary of State enforcement authority. So it's not a decision of this Secretary of State or the next Secretary of State. It's simply a lack of enforcement authority provided in the statute. Could the statute be changed to provide that enforcement authority? Of course it could, but that's simply not the way the statute is structured right now.
Let me ask you an unrelated question, and if you would address this in with maybe one of the counsel for appellants would as well. You know, neither of you availed yourself of the opportunity or rules to weigh in on whether or not we should issue a precedential opinion in this matter. Do you have thoughts about that?
Based upon the Secretary's argument, the Secretary's position is this is purely a case of ripeness and justiciability, which is well-settled law in the state. It does not seem that a published opinion or a precedential opinion would be warranted because this is merely an application of established precedent and from the Secretary's position, well-established precedent as to how we adjudicate ripeness and justiciability questions in state courts. The only unique aspect here is there is a dearth of First Amendment cases dealing specifically with this justiciability question, but there's no reason it shouldn't apply equally well to both. And I know that the DFL has made the argument that First Amendment jurisprudence is essentially wide open and First Amendment claims should be given wide latitude. Not necessarily disputing that, but there still has to be a case in controversy. Just because you're making a First Amendment claim doesn't mean you get a pure advisory opinion. Advisory opinions are still disliked by the court, whether it's a First Amendment challenge or not. And that's essentially what we're looking for here, because there is no controversy between the Secretary of State and either of these parties in this respect. That doesn't mean that this statute will never properly come before a court. There are plenty of statutes that don't involve the state as an enforcing authority that come up before the court in the employment context, in contracts, in property law. There's plenty of disputes that happen between people out in the world that don't involve the state. And for those reasons, and for all the reasons we've talked about, unless there are further questions, I see my time has expired. We ask that the court affirm the dismissal of both cases. Thank you.
I have, before you sit down, Mr. Melchioni, I have one question about, Judge Jessen, are you finished with your line of questioning? Thank you. Your reference to First Amendment case law about ripeness, the word chill is frequently used, and that typically refers to the First Amendment right of free speech. As I understand it, the underlying basis of the constitutional claims here is the First Amendment right of association. Do you think that case law concerning free speech, if I understand it correctly, is equally applicable to the specific constitutional right being asserted by the appellants?
In general, yes. The body of case law dealing with the justiciability of these types of claims, despite the fact that there are some disparities among circuits, has been fairly uniform. And I think everyone here agrees that the controlling case is 281 CARES. Whether you're viewing this as a pure speech case or as a association case, and it does have tinges of both, 281 CARES says that chilling in and of itself can be a harm assuming that chilling is objectively reasonable based upon a credible threat of prosecution. And at this point, based upon all the arguments I've heard and all of the briefing, that is the standard we have all agreed should be applied here. The question is, how do we do it?
Thank you for that answer, and thank you for your argument. It is now time for rebuttal. If I remember correctly, counsel for Mr. McCourt will go first. Please correct me if I'm wrong, but if I'm not wrong about that, counsel for Appellant McCourt, you may introduce yourself and then present your oral your rebuttal argument limited to 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I just had an opportunity to briefly confer with our co-counsel. We'd like to take 90 seconds and just to respond very directly to your Honor's specific concerns to Mr. McCourt, and then yield 90 seconds to the DFL. And again, this is Simon Troutman appearing on behalf of Mr. Noah McCourt. And I wanted to address the specific question regarding whether or not Mr. McCourt should refer to his parole officer and just express just how concerning it is to our client and to into the process of law that his First Amendment rights are deferred to a parole officer to give his legal analysis of whether or not, say, the DFL party or the Secretary of State has the reasonable authority to enforce the law given the plain meaning of the statute. And so there are two possible positive outcomes for Mr. McCourt. One is that we find that this is unconstitutional, that that his speech would be so chilled or so diminished, or that the court would say, we agree with all parties that this law as written is not enforceable. And if Mr. McCourt had the clarity that was not enforceable, that this law was not enforceable either through constitutionality or through the ambiguous enforcement mechanisms of the statute, then he would have clarity and the party would have clarity that that there would be no threat of any kind of enforcement, whether civil or criminal, and either would be a sufficient harm. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Troutman. Counsel for Appellant DFL, you may present your rebuttal argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to start with the credible threat standard. So a credible threat is simply one that is not imaginary or wholly speculative. The question the court needs to ask is whether it's credible that if the DFL opened up participation at the caucuses to any non-eligible voter, whether, you know, a felon who's still on paper or a dreamer could potentially be prosecuted under the statute, or whether a Secretary of State, perhaps not this one, but perhaps a future Secretary of State, would bring some enforcement action against the party. And I want to point this court's attention to United Food, which is an Eighth Circuit case that we cited in our brief. There, the certainty that it will does not establish the lack of a case or controversy for a First Amendment claim. Nothing here really insulates the party's members from felony prosecutions. And we also need to remember who we're dealing with. The party wants to open up the caucuses to, you know, people like Mr. McCourt, who are on probation. A felony prosecution would put him back in prison. If a dreamer underwent a felony prosecution, they could be deported. And so the secretary's position puts the DFL in an impossible position of either continuing to chill its speech and limit its participation in the caucuses, or risk, you know, the deportation or imprisonment of its members. And that's simply what the First Amendment pre-enforcement case law is intended to avoid. Now, I want to touch on, you know, the secretary has stated that he believes that the statute is not enforceable, but that is precisely the lesson that Poe teaches us, which is that one state official's belief that the statute is not enforceable does not bind a future official who can change the policy and bring an enforcement action. Of course, not 4 years after the court in Poe ruled that the statute was a dead letter, you know, a case was prosecuted for a violation of the statute. And yes, Your Honor.
Wouldn't that kind of analysis lead us to say, look, perhaps, you know, that this case is not justiciable now, but we understand that circumstances can change. And, you know, we're not saying that, you know, any party couldn't bring up this situation if there is a threat of prosecution in the future or prosecution.
Well, yes, Your Honor. So what I'm saying is that the secretary's position in this litigation does not make this claim non-justiciable. Let me touch on subdivision 3. There's a distinction between participation and voting at the caucuses. The statute does not, you know, it considers those separately. So the right of the party to determine who participates does not change the fact that only eligible voters can vote or be elected delegates at the caucuses. And finally, the secretary, you know, analogizes his publishing of the election laws to, you know, a library providing the statute books to the public, but that's simply not a credible argument coming from the state's chief election official, Your Honor. And I'll note that we have in the record both the copy of the Secretary of State's website, which states that to participate in the caucuses, you must be eligible to vote in the next general election and live in the precinct. It doesn't say anything such as the party alone has the right to determine whether or not you can participate in the caucuses. And in the statutorily required guide that the Secretary of State publishes for local election officials, this also states that precinct caucuses are open to anyone who is eligible to vote or will be eligible by the state general election. And again, does not even contain a reference to subdivision 3 purporting to place the enforcement authority with the party. So in closing, Your Honor, the DFL has done precisely what the courts encourage parties to do, bring an action to clarify its associational rights under the law prior to simply breaking the law. And for these reasons, we request the court reverse and remand for consideration on the merits. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kitsy Collins, for your rebuttal. Thank you to all lawyers for your arguments. The case is now submitted, and the court will issue its opinion in writing within 90 days.